Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
And we're back, and I'm excited. I'm excited every day to be on the radio, but you know, I'm really excited. I can't even get my introduction out. Andrew Zatlin's on the line with me. That's why I'm so excited. He is the Moneyball Economist, editor of Moneyball Economics. Moneyballeconomics.com is the website. We had Andrew on a while back, and he graciously and generously agreed to come back and spend a little more time with us because last time we ran out of time, and I know that there's more things that have been going on, and we talked to Andrew quite a bit about the economics and the economy, unemployment, indicators of what's to come, which is, of course, what everybody wants to know. We don't want to know what happened in the past. We want to know what's going to happen in the future so we can make plans and invest accordingly. And we'll do a quick review about Moneyball Economics and then get Andrew's update on what's been happening in the world. And I love what you do, Andrew. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. God, David, I need to somehow get you to write my blurbs for me. Wow, that was a powerful introduction. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Listen, you just let me know, and I'll dial in wherever you are, and I'll do the introduction.
We have to clarify for the listeners. No, he's not on the take. I'm not paying him to be this kind. He's a great cheerleader, I guess. Thank you.
Much. Well, listen, you give up your time. You got the time. I've got the beer. That's the way I look at it. Okay. All right. So speaking.
Wow, it's been a couple months.
Yeah, so speaking of beer and vices, let's reacquaint the listeners that maybe missed either missed out or only caught part of our last interview. You've got a really different take on how to assess the fundamental economic strength of our economy. And you, of course, have your business experience and, you know, you MBA, and you've done a lot of work in the semiconductor, 20-year veteran of semiconductor networking world. So you come from that business background, but you tapped into a whole other way of really getting a sense for how our economy is doing. So kind of revisit.
Yeah. To recap, so it's very straightforward what I'm doing. It's just that I'm harnessing data that maybe might have been ignored for various reasons, which we'll kind of acknowledge in a minute. I mean, ultimately, the economy, what I'm looking at are two chains, the production chain and the consumption chain. And on the production end, I look at everything from semiconductors, the universal common denominator these days for the economy.
Right.
And then I look at everything, goods, shipments. Basically, the movement and the manufacturing of stuff around the world. I look at that. And then, you know, we're moving stuff around the world that hopefully will get bought. And so I then look at, from the consumption cycle, what are businesses doing? What are they buying? And then that gets us to the vice index, which is saying, and what are consumers doing? Where are they spending their money? And is it accelerating or decelerating? Now, that sounds very nice and very theoretical. The reality is I then take that and I do forecasting because, you know, we want to know if we're accelerating, and that's, you know, where should we put our money as investors? And if
right.
it's decelerating, where should we put our money or take our money off? When it comes to consumers, I'm looking at something, and you know, this actually has the seal of approval of the Bank of England. Did you know that today, as of a couple of months ago, the Bank of England is now measuring the UK's economy and GDP, including two new factors, illegal drugs and prostitution? Now, why is that, right? When you look outside of the US and you look at other economies, what you'll find is that the gray market, the underground economy, is massive. For example, in Russia, it's over 50% of their total economy is this untracked underground economy.
Wow.
It exists primarily as tax dodging. You know, these are countries where taxes and corruption kind of go hand in hand as things people have to deal with. When we get to the U.S., it's still sizable. You're still talking about $1 trillion plus under most estimates of illegal drugs, prostitution, and other things that we call vices. This is a massive part of our economy. The Bank of England has stepped up and said, it's so big, we should be tracking it. So how are we going to do that? Well, I stepped out a couple years ago and said, well, I think I kind of cracked the code. I can track a lot of these things that we call vices. Some of them are legal. For example, drinking, gambling. Some of them are illegal. Prostitution, drugs. Drugs now suddenly becoming a little bit more legal, more mainstreaming. But they all have one thing in common. Everybody's doing it. Everybody has a vice. Everybody's indulging. Everybody has a luxury that has no ultimate utility. It's just a feel-good thing. And what I've been able to do is quantify all these tens of millions of people who are, for example, in Las Vegas, every week, 1 million people go to Las Vegas.
Mm.
Every week. Atlantic City, same thing. We're talking tens of millions of people are gambling. Tens of millions of people are smoking pot. That's more people out there spending more money on a regular basis than practically anything else in our economy. Gasoline, okay, yeah, we can start throwing out some things out there. But
right.
By and large, this is your discretionary spending out there. And what I've been able to do is not just quantify it, but tie it back to the overall economy and back to these mainstream economic benchmarks that get thrown out every week and every month.
Okay. So you're using the, just to simplify from kind of my perspective here, is you're taking the trillion-dollar under the table, under the covers economy, and you're using that to project and be able to make sense of the $16 trillion legal economy.
Yeah, and even better, because they do go hand in hand. You have to, the other aspect of this that makes it so useful as a barometer is, number one, it's leading.
People yes,
will
like
start
that.
Spending money today if they feel rich, and they'll spend it on treats. So it's got a leading factor to it,
Trick or treats.
Well, what's that? I'm not trying to be careful with my wording here, right?
I said trick or treats.
Exactly.
Sorry.
No. I mean, trust me, it's an interesting place to have to spend time. Fortunately, I can never expense this stuff.
Listen,
darn it.
Andrew, as long as you're not getting high on your own supply, okay?
Exactly. No, I'm an observer.
Okay.
I'm strictly an observer here. Imagine me with a clipboard on the street corner kind of thing. But the reality is, I'm harnessing millions of data points to get to this information. Okay, it's much more robust than the consumer sentiment benchmark
sure.
that comes out each month, which is 400 people. Hey man,
yeah.
that 400 people are telling me how I feel versus a few million people. Which would you rather leverage?
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's also cash. Remember, when it's illegal, you're dealing with cash.
Right.
And so that again gets to the heart of why it's a leading indicator, because you can't throw your credit card down at the dispensaries in Colorado to buy a bag of weed. Cash.
Not yet.
So that, yeah. What's that?
Well, so that's the framework where you're coming from, and that's very helpful. And so the big question is, with your current sampling and assessments and evaluations of all these data points and this nice bigger population to draw from, that the proverbial important question is, where are we now versus where we were maybe a few months back?
We are in an interesting shift that's been going on, I'm going to say, for at least 6 months. And it's an interesting shift because it fits where we are in the economic cycle. People today in America have shifted away, there's a preference shift, away from buying stuff and buying experiences. Vices happen to be experiences. But the reality is, when you look at some of these numbers that are coming out and people are, saying, gosh, the spring rebound, right? Cold weather
right,
hit
right,
us and
right.
people couldn't get out and spend. So
right.
And then we kind of turned the corner and people were expecting this immediate rebound. Well, it doesn't quite work that way for two reasons. The first is, we've already maxed out how many cars we're going to be buying. People aren't suddenly going to rush out and buy a third or fourth car the way they were doing 10 years ago when the credit bubble was going on. We've kind of bought everything we need. We have a smartphone that's less than 2 years old. We have TVs that are less than 2-3 years old. We have the stuff we need. And when you get to a point where people are satisfied, it's kind of like going to the buffet,
mm-hmm.
it's dessert time.
Right.
It's coffee and dessert
right,
time right,
right, right.
It's not that we're not eating. It's not that we're not happy. It's I already had the prime rib and the lobster tails that I'm going to have. I'm good with that. I just need
right.
a little something extra. And so that's why if you look at what's happening in the tourism part of our economy, oh my God, what airlines has not crushed their numbers lately?
Right.
What hotel has not crushed their numbers lately? Disneyland raised prices, and you know what? They're still sold out.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And this is in the face of a strong dollar where you're not getting Europeans coming over, you're not getting as many Chinese coming over to tourism. It doesn't matter. These companies are doing really well because the experience, people are traveling, they're going places, they're spending their money on something that they're not, it's a more time and experience. I mean, that's showing up in the Vice Index numbers as well. There is one nuance here, though, I'd like to sort of throw on the table.
Sure.
What's interesting is in the Vice numbers, we're getting back to, again, a polarization where the haves and the have-nots are spending differently. So lower income Vice spending is actually starting to pull back again.
Interesting.
It was running up the end of last year and into the early part of this year. Now it's pulling back again. And I don't really know what that means. I don't know what's causing that. You know, my first instinct is to say it's a gas, sort of the end of the gas pump dividend. Remember, regressive tax and all that. You know, gasoline hits lower income a lot harder than it does higher income. And so, I mean, let's face it, gas prices no longer are going down. Right?
Suspect they bottomed
a long time ago. They've been steadily kind of creeping up. And if we say that they're even flat, it's still not like it was a few months ago when it was in the $40 range, barrels of oil. Now it's in the $60 range.
Right. That's probably not all the story. There's probably more to it than that for that lower income population with their vice spending.
You know, I'm scratching my head.
Yeah, there's something else going on.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is. And you know, unlike others, I'm not willing to stick my neck out and make a claim because I just don't know. I mean, that's a good part about being a moneyball economist is you've got to be data-driven. You've got to go with what the data's telling you, not with what your agenda might be. I just can't translate the information. I don't have enough. But I do know that the lower income's kind of pulling back. And what this means is, overall, when we talk in terms of things like retail and all these other, you know, where's the economy going to be going in the next couple of months? You know, my observation is we're on a downslope. You know, it's the eighth inning going into the ninth inning, in the sense that the economy growth, the economic growth is slowing down. I think today, for example, the IMF came out and said, oh my God, it's slowing down. The U.S. is crashing, right? They took the forecasted GDP down from 3.1% to 2.5%. It's not time, you know, to run around henny-penny and the sky is falling.
Right.
But it's time to recognize that if you're invested in bonds or in the stock market, things are shifting. You see the payroll. At the end of last year, we were averaging 260,000 new jobs a month. Now, we're kind of 200,000.
Mm.
Some of that's isolated. You know, a lot of that's manufacturing getting hit, the oil industry getting hit. But overall, for the overall economy, we're on this steady-as-you-go trajectory. And that's what the Vice data is saying. You know, you're not seeing this uptick in demand. That's the one thing that's not happening.
Mm.
But you're not seeing a pullback yet either. It's just sort of this plateau kind of feeling.
It's a low.
Yeah, and when you get to this point, I mean, let's face it, are we entering our seventh year of the recovery? You know, when you get to this point where it's long in the tooth of a recovery, things, you know, we're kind of peaking. And I think in every benchmark you look at, you know, we've kind of reached that point of saturation where it's the plateau. There's only one place to go, and that's slower. It doesn't mean that there's going to be a full-form pullback. It does mean things are slower, and that translates into, you know, companies are right now claiming that their top line is getting hit by overseas pricing. You know, either the strong dollar is limiting sales, or it's just it's sort of a mathematical thing. You know, when you translate those dollars, you know, when you translate the yen back into dollar, it just doesn't translate as well. And that's definitely happening. But we also have to recognize that the U.S. economy is really 70% standalone. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really
export.
You know, we're kind of standalone. I'm not saying we're buffered and we're immune. I'm just saying, you know, if the economy is slowing down, it's because we're slowing down primarily. It's not a marginal thing. It's not happening out on the hinterland type of thing. We want to buy, you know. You'll see organic growth. And when you get to organic growth, you know, and the companies aren't accelerating their top line, they've got to focus on managing the bottom line. And that's when CEOs, unfortunately, start to talk in terms of
cuts,
layoffs,
yeah,
less high, you know, bonuses and things like that.
Well, Andrew, I'll tell you what, that means they may have to take a break. So we need to do the same. So let's grab a quick break. We'll come right back with Andrew Zatlin, Moneyball Economist, editor of Moneyball Economics, moneyballeconomics.com. We'll be right back.
Does getting financial advice seem like a game of cat and mouse? Maybe it's time to hire a fiduciary, a financial professional who puts the needs of his clients ahead of his own. A fiduciary also means an advisor should recommend products and services he believes will best serve his clients' needs, not what an insurance company or investment company tells him he has to sell. Next time you're talking to an advisor, ask him, "Are you a fiduciary? Yes or no?" If the advisor doesn't know, then the answer's probably no. This public service announcement is brought to you by Holland Financial, who wants to help you to plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen. Andrew Zatlin came back to us, and we're glad he did. Moneyball Economist, moneyballeconomics.com is the website. And You know, there's a lot of data that I'm hearing that you're crunching through and you're looking at, and some of it's a little bit yet to be firmed up. But the sense I'm getting from what you shared before the break, Andrew, is that that all is not rosy. We are in that kind of, you know, where we're kind of going sideways a little bit. It may be that 2015 ends up being a, you know, a somewhat of a flat year for the market. And, you know, in my world, that's okay. And, but I tell you what it also tells me is that it kind of reinforces this idea that I don't know that the Federal Reserve really is going to be any haste to raise rates, especially with the, even though the unemployment is lower, the official rate, there's so much lack of participation that it seems to me that that would be where the focus would be on people just giving up.
Let's talk about that for a second. What I think is the primary, let's just level set here and make sure that everyone understands what we're talking about when we talk about participation. What we're talking about is the way unemployment gets measured. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors. You and I, commonsensical, would say, let's use a number. Let's say there are 200 people out there who could be working. Let's say there are 180 jobs pop up. Right, so 180 out of the 200 people are now working. You and I would say, well, wait, there's 20 people out of 200. Unemployment would be 10%. That's what we would say.
Right.
All right, so now, let's say, okay, let's say another 10 of those 20 people, 10 of them keep looking, but 10 of them say, you know what? For this, that, the others, I'm not going to look anymore.
Right, right.
This is where it gets crazy.
Right.
The unemployment rate that gets reported would say, oh, well, wait a second. Even though our original base is still 200 people, we're going to say that only 190 of them are really looking for work. So instead of it being 20 out of that 200, it's 10 out of 190.
Right.
Holy cow, we've conquered the unemployment problem.
Look at that. Our economy's on a roll.
Yeah, woo! Jobs. And that's what's happening. So labor participation, which goes to the heart of how many people could be working versus how many people are looking for work, has actually collapsed. It's gone down from the 67% zone a few years ago to barely 64%. And just to kind of put a number on that, that's 5 million people who are perfectly eligible to be working, but have decided not to.
Mm.
Why is that? Who are these people? Let's pick up the phone. Let's call them. Let's give them a job.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we know who they are a lot of times. Not necessarily by name, but we know a lot of them have given up and they've decided to take, maybe they just take another route, maybe take benefits, take whatever,
no.
You know.
I'm going to disagree with you, David. I know exactly who they are.
Oh, you do?
Their kids under 24.
All right.
You know the unemployment rate.
Well, then we are going to their house.
They're sitting at home in the basement. I mean, I'm not kidding here. You're talking about an overall unemployment of, what, 5.4%?
Mm.
Kids under 24, I'm an old man, so anyone under 24 is a kid, right?
Yeah.
But for youth, we'll call them. You're talking about 10, and depending on the age, 20% unemployment. What's happened here is that entry-level jobs, the traditional entry-level jobs, have disappeared. Construction, retail, restaurant. Those jobs have disappeared. And that's where you see actually the higher levels of unemployment. Overall, unemployment is 5.4%. For construction, it's, I think, 7.5%. For retail, it's 7.8% or something like that.
Well, it also
could
be
young people. They're out of work.
Yeah, and it also could be those jobs that are available in that sector that those persons would normally get. They might be occupied by somebody who is,
not moving on up.
Yeah, or somebody who's taken that spot because they couldn't find something else and they're vastly more qualified.
I'll also throw out there's a definite job skill mismatch. The jobs in demand today, entry-level jobs, believe it or not, are software programming. Now, you think, well, wait, software programming, that's impossible. And I'm going to say, you know, I'm in Silicon Valley. Software programming should be taught in high school as a remedial class, just the way you would teach shop. Okay? Software programming is not rocket science. It is to me because I'm an old dude and I can't pick this stuff up. But it's like music. You can teach it. You can learn it. You don't have to be a brilliant musician. You don't have to conquer the world. I mean, for every Steve Jobs that's out there, there are a few thousand people who he brought along. And you know, they may not have been the visionary or the genius that he was, but they can still, they're mechanics. They can still crank out software. So you have a job skill mismatch. And that's why you have all these H-1 visas out there, because we just can't get. When I do my website, I would love to hire anyone in America. I can't find somebody in America to do my website. Start here.
So instead of retreading tires, teaching them how to retread tires, teach them how to do software engineering and programming.
We have, unfortunately, so the good thing is we've got a lot of positives on the table. So if we talk in terms of things slowing down, we're actually in a good place for a slowdown. I know it's kind of weird to say good place for a slowdown, but we're very lean as an economy right now. We have, throughout the supply chain, you know, we've been very vicious at getting rid of underperforming factories. Like GM went from 5 to 3 factories in just a few years. So you've got a very lean supply chain. You have a very lean labor market. And so if there is going to be a recession or a pullback, it's not going to be like it was a few years ago where it was just decimation. And that's a good thing, you know, in terms of the blowback. We're also in an interesting place, though, where the government has thrown a lot of money at this skill problem. A lot of money was thrown at it. I think lately we're hearing about companies like ITT, which are private educational institutions, mm-hmm. which took a lot of this money and looks like they didn't do the right things with the money.
Mm.
But the idea is the government has stepped up and said, look, we're willing to underwrite the effort to retrain people, to give them these skills. The problem is, you know, it's not just throwing money at the problem to get to the right solution. You have to go all the way back and recognize, and this is where the Fed has full culpability, there's structural change. To sit there and say this is a cyclical problem, meaning,
right.
oh, it's just a matter of the business cycle, we'll recreate 2 million construction jobs. No.
Right.
We as a society need to step up and say, you know what?
It's different.
We are less manual labor oriented than we were. That's not going to change. This is a digital economy. We are in the 21st century now. We are firmly in it. And what does that mean from a job skill set, demand, supply alignment? And right now we're not there. And you know, when I hear things like, who was it that just gave $400 million to Harvard?
Mm.
Now, come on, Harvard doesn't need
Paulson.
The money.
Mm-hmm.
You could put a computer in every classroom with that $400 million. You could put a Chromebook in every classroom. You could jumpstart single-handedly the solution. I look at that and I just go, oh my God, what a waste of money.
Mm-hmm.
What a waste of
Well, hold on now, Andrew. Maybe Harvard will turn around and send those Chromebooks to each classroom.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure they do because Harvard spends all those billions of dollars they have in their little slush fund.
Yeah.
Society, you know, we're trying to do the right things here. We rely on government. And government recycling the money and redistributing it in the right ways. And they've tried. And you can't point a finger mm-hmm. at them and say they've done a great job or a bad job. There's always room for improvement. I think that we as a society, as individuals, need to step back and say, wait a second. What do we want? How are we going to get there? And you know what? It's such a competitive global market that, you know, we're up against countries like China who are very clear about what's needed. And we'll put the money down and we'll determine top down what that economy is going to look like. And by gosh, they're getting there.
Mm.
And if we don't step up, do some of the same things, yeah, we're going to have some pain.
Oh, no question.
Unfortunately, it's America. We tend to step up, but I'd rather have a step up sooner rather than later. And oh, by the way, if we're coming to a recession in the next year, a recession, lowercase r, you know, hey, it's just not growing anymore. Things are kind of taking a step back. We don't really have any ammunition. I mean, the Fed still is sitting on, what, $20 trillion of debt? All they're doing is rolling it over. We're not
right.
out of the... They don't have any bullets in their gun anymore. And then, to bring it back, we were talking about a rate hike. Really, a rate hike. Right now, you've got guiding down across the board around the world, the macroeconomies. The U.S. has just been guided down pretty significantly. The rest of the world... And by the way, when these institutions like the IMF declare something, they're 6 months out. They're 6 months too late. They never know what's going on until it's just way too late to deny the reality. The reality is the rest of the world is really in a bad place. China is slowing down much faster than the official data says. EU, they're recessionary right now. My data shows completely they're recessionary. Whether the official data wants to say it or not, we're going to get excited about 0.2% growth? Really?
Yeah.
Is that exciting? Really? They're recessionary. We don't have growth going on, and it's slowing down faster. And into that, you have the Fed saying they're going to step up with a rate hike? I mean, to me, it really comes down to a couple things. On the one hand, it's a symbolic gesture. The Fed has to say we are in control.
Right. They got to stay relevant.
Yeah. It's relevant to what's going on. You know, you hear things like, oh, the data is going to determine blah, blah. No. They don't want to raise interest rates. Also, because functionally, if you raise interest rates, you now make it costlier for the U.S. government to pay down that $20 trillion.
Of course.
Boom, 0.25%, that's a couple $100 billion that could be spent somewhere else. Instead, it's gone up in smoke. They don't want to raise rates. but they have to simply to say that we're the Fed and we're in charge. And there's also pressure. You know, not everyone dives into the numbers as deeply as I do. They simply look at the headline numbers and say, wait a second, 5.4% unemployment. We just came out of a second half of the year where the GDP was clocking in at 4 and 5%. Okay, we'll discount the last quarter, you know, as noise because of weather, this, that, and the other. If you can't raise rates now, my God, when can you, right? Mm. The economy looks great. Well, there's a lot of other things happening below the surface. And then, you know, looking out, like I said, you know, it's not just what's happening today or months ago, but what's about to happen. And, you know, I look at that and I say, you know, is there a rate hike? They've gotten the impact of a rate hike without raising rates.
They've talked about
it. Jawboning about it.
Right, exactly.
So maybe they don't have to, you know, and you know, everyone's sort of twisting on the axle. You know, my concern is this. Inflation's about to kick up for a couple of reasons. Reason number one, the gas-induced deflation is going to wind down by the second half.
Sure.
It's done. It's played out. We've got massive food inflation in the pipeline, and California drought's really bad. It's going to drive up food prices. People say, yeah, but that's not core. You know, that's food and energy, and we always take that out. And I say, yeah, that maybe in the theoretical world, in the wallet world where I live, no, if my food's going up, it's less Starbucks I'm going to be buying or something, right? But keep going with this. It's not just all these other things that will come back. We've got rent. Rent's another one that you got to look at. The way the CPI gets calculated, rent is a big portion of that. Rent equivalent, I should say. So they look at housing and rent, and they say, you know, this is what's going on, and inflation is as a result. For the past couple of years, this is sort of a mathematical thing. For the past
You know what? Oh, we won't be able to get into the math. Andrew Zatlin, you are a man of much information, and we'll have to have you back. The Moneyball economist, editor of Moneyball Economics, moneyballeconomics.com. And Andrew, it's fascinating. I can sit back and get your insights, and it's good stuff. And I think that the takeaway for people is that they can go to your website. They can sign up for the newsletter I have. It's very,
all free.
It's very convenient, and we can keep track of what's happening and even a little bit of sense of what's happening with devices. So thank you, Andrew, and we'll have you back again.
Thanks, David.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.